Welcome to C2Y Podcast, discussions on child and youth care. My name is Wolfgang Vachon. In Canada, we recently had our Thanksgiving holiday. This was the same day that the USA recognized Columbus Day. Columbus Day is in honor of Christopher Columbus, who came to the Americas a little over 500 years ago. The impact of Europeans' arrival on indigenous peoples across the Americas has been significant. A December 2001 issue of National Geographic looked at recently published DNA studies which estimate the indigenous population of the Americas dropped to half of its pre-European contact after Columbus arrived. In Canada, there was recently a United Nations Special Rapporteur who looked at the situation of Aboriginal people in Canada. At the end of the visit, he is quoted as saying, "From all I learned, I can only conclude that Canada faces a crisis when it comes to the situation of Indigenous peoples of the country." He cited education, with Aboriginal people aged 25 to 64 having significantly less post-secondary education compared to the national average. At least one in five Aboriginal Canadians live in homes in need of serious repair, often overcrowded or contaminated with mold. The suicide rate among Inuit and First Nations youth living on reserves is five times the national average. Aboriginal women are eight times more likely to be murdered than non-Aboriginal women, and Aboriginal people face disproportionately higher rates of incarceration than non-Aboriginals. C2Y Podcast has had several other interviews with Indigenous peoples from around the world, including Bedouin, First Nations, and Palestinian. Many of the same issues arise across the planet. These facts are alarming and need to be discussed. What else needs to be discussed is the capacity, valuable legacy, and Indigenous ways of addressing these situations. How many of us are taught that freeze-drying, chocolate, vanilla, popcorn, parkas, hypodermic needles, and ball games were all first used or practiced by Native North Americans? How many of us are aware that of the innovative Aboriginal programs in prisons? How many of us know how the issues facing Native youth are being addressed by Native people? Today, I'm speaking with Daniel Wolfshadow Winkler. Daniel Wolfshadow is the Director of Native American Programs at Natchez Trace Youth Academy. He is a member of the Lakota Nation and has spent his career working with Native youth who have been identified as at risk. Welcome, Daniel Wolfshadow.
Thank you, Wolfgang. I sure appreciate you being and talking to me and calling me. I want to say, good morning. Good morning and a good day in my language.
Thank you. I hope it will be a good day for everybody today.
When we look at things in that way, and we greet the sun according to the Oglala Lakota people where I'm from, you know, and we ask that sun for that beautiful day, and we walk on that road, you know, that comes. You know, the gifts, whether that we see in the trees and the things that flow and things that crawl the four legs of the wings, we find that good day either way. It's a beautiful way to wake up this morning when I left our door, as I try to always live, our door faces east this week, and we face the sun when we get up, and across from my house is a field, about 100 acres. And it was foggy and dewy this morning, and there were hundreds of spider webs across the field, and dew hanging them off of that. You know, and that reminds me always of how we're all interconnected in this life, you and your family way over there, and me here, and how we can all live in harmony like that. Know that there's enough space on Mother Earth for us to share in the beauty, you with the sun to your back there and me with the sun to my face here. That's interconnectedness.
Indeed. Indeed. In the introduction, I spoke about some not so beautiful realities facing people. In fact, some pretty appalling realities facing Aboriginal people, at least in Canada. Why is this the situation of Aboriginal people in Canada and North America and the broader Americas?
Yeah, again, we're interconnected. When You know, Fool's Call talked about in the beginning that we were all of one people, that we were meant to, when we all lived together, the creator of Asantanka, the great mystery, said, these people go north and they learn what the north has to teach, and these people go south and they learn what that area needs to teach, and the same with east and west. And we're to go and learn from these directions, fire, water, you know, air and earth, and learn what those directions meant for us. And we were to come back. This is the creation story. We were to come back and teach each other those lessons. Greed came involved and things came involved, and we ended up with what we have today. You did mention earlier the arrival of Columbus and what we consider the arrival of the invaders into a land that was already well-populated, that was advanced, had systems in place, had knowledge in place, had culture in place. You know, in those times when we would have visiting tribes or visiting people from other areas, one of the first questions that we were asked when the tribal leaders would meet, whether it was the clan of women or the war societies or the medicine men, the visiting tribe, first question they would ask us is, how are the children? And if we as a tribe can say, the children are healthy, then that meant we as a people were healthy. When the arrival of the intruders came, we couldn't say that anymore. We couldn't, because, you know, things started to change. You know, Indigenous people, First Nations people from in Canada, First Nations, original Aboriginal people here on this side of the lake, were giving people, always have been, because that's the way that we were taught. You know, if somebody doesn't have something, then you share. You know, that's the meaning of the medicine wheel. That's the meaning of the circle of life, that you share with those people. Things got convoluted, you know. More Westernology started to come in. Of course, the doors of slavery were opened. Back when when Christopher Columbus, you had mentioned his arrival, you know, nearly over 10 million Native people, roughly 90% of the existing population were extinct, you know, sent back as slaves. Christopher Columbus made a statement to Queen Isabella and King Fernando at that time in Spain. He had said that these would make fine servants, that with 50 men, we could subjugate them all and make them do whatever we want. And so that's how it went. You know, Christopher Columbus had wrote a paper from his boat and had said that without compass or without map, you could follow the dead bodies of the Taino Indians, which were the Caribbean Indians, the Taino Indians. You could follow their bodies from Spain all the way from the Caribbeans all the way back to Espanol, is what I had written, or what he had written, what I had read. Hmm. So that's the beginning of that devastation.
And that devastation has continued on for the past 500 years. I know in Canada, for example, we had a residential school system which, removed children. So the children were not healthy. The children were removed from their homes and put in what is euphemistically called schools, really, you know, work camps, whose purpose was to remove the Indian, as they said. And after many of the residential schools closed down in Canada, we had a what is called the 60s scoop, where many children were removed from their homes and put into foster care, most frequently non-Aboriginal, non-Native families. And to this day, we have more First Nations children in foster care than were ever in residential schools at any one time. And that's really seen as the residential schools as one of the most horrific situations in the history of Canada, relationship with First Nations people. Are there a similar process that happened in the U.S.?
Well, without a doubt, you're talking about forced relocation, the boarding school period, you know, devastation to our children. If you take a look at it this way, these boarding schools were so successful. One of the first boarding schools here, what they call boarding schools, or more appropriately, you would see the name out front of these buildings, Indian Training School. Okay, you know, if you think about that, what are they going to train the Indian to do? The purpose of all that, Wolfgang, was for simulation. The word of that time was kill the Indian but save the human. They were aware well that you know, with Indian people, we believe in the fiascafe, or the extended family, and that the children were sacred. Their voice meant something. Their presence meant something. It wasn't never, well, you could hear that old saying, children to be seen but never heard. That's not how we did things traditionally. The child's voice was very important, and that love and that surrounding. So the assimilation in the boarding school process was simply that, to assimilate native people into a different way of thinking. So during that reservation time, what happened is these boarding schools started popping up. Carlisle Indian School there in Carlisle, Pennsylvania was one of the first. And then many, many other contracts for these schools started popping up. There was 100,000 children that had passed through these brainwashing portals. 100,000 Indian children. Very few ever came home. Now, if you look at it this way, how those residue effects of that happens, the intergenerational trauma, okay? The children are forcibly removed from the family because there's no food, there's no warmth, there's no housing. So the most important thing to the mother and the father is, well, we must protect our children. If we have no choice but to send these children to these schools that were so far away from their homeland, that of course the parents could not visit. And that was done on purpose. Now, with the parents thinking, okay, I'm sending my child over here, my sacred being over here to be taught, he's going to have some clothes and he's going to be able to eat. That wasn't the case. It was starvation, it was depression, it was medical experiments, it was sexual abuse that was going on with these children. Imagine going into a place where your hair's cut off, your style clothing is changed, you're not allowed to speak your language, and these schools teach you every day that the way that they lived traditionally was Sabbath-like and unchristian, that it was not the way to be. So without the traditional ceremonies, without the language, without the formation of culture and home and village, these children were desperate and alone. Many, many, many died. It was threefold, Wolfgang. When and if these children ever came back, they didn't feel like a part of that tribe anymore. They couldn't speak the language. They couldn't perform ceremonies. And they thought in their mind that the ways of their ancestors were savage and not the way they were supposed to be. So what effects does that have on the parents? My God, the parents feel guilty. What have I done to my child? What have I done to my child that he doesn't love me anymore? So now you have depression going back to the parents, the children nowhere feeling like they don't belong, creates that broken hoop, that devastation.
You have spent your career working with young people who've been affected by this devastation. You work at a place called Natchez Trace Youth Academy, and you're the director of Native Programs. Why have a director of Native Programs?
It's important, we'll say, again, and we can go back to the boarding schools. You know, this Natchez Trace Youth Academy is a residential treatment facility. We practice things in a holistic, traditional way, strength-based practices. You have evidence-based practices, you have strength-based practices, but they intertwine as well. To have a director of Native Program is someone who is of blood, who is recognizably and is connected traditionally to the original tribes here in North America, helps to gain the trust of tribal members of all nations. You got to remember that they remember the old boarding schools, how how better say that was to their families. So there's seeing these residue effects of historical trauma, and then you have somebody coming up and saying, oh, our school's really good for you. Our school will do well for these children. They're having trouble. They're using alcohol. They're using drugs. They're committing suicide. All the things that are going on with these kids. And we're asking the parents to trust a school that may be far away from their homelands, far away from their reservation lands, to help heal their child. What's the first thing they're going to think? You know, or are we sending our children back to these old-time boarding schools? Is that what's happening? It's important to show that we are a culturally appropriate program. And the way that we do that is you have staff, you have some that oversees that, understands what those old boarding schools were about and what historical trauma is and how do we bring those children back to a sense of belonging. That's the key, to give them back that sense of belonging. If you go on our reservations today, Wolfgang, and you walk amongst the youth that know their language, that know their ceremonies, that understand where they come from, they are not at risk. It's the kids and the youth that did not or do not have that opportunity for positive growth and positive leadership with natural and logical consequences and rewards. That's the purpose of my position, to see to it that we're doing what we're supposed to do.
So you talk about having holistic, evidence-based, and strength-based practices. You talk about reacquainting young people with their heritage, with their culture, with their ceremonies. What does that look like in practice? How do you blend holistic evidence base, which tends to be a very traditional medical model, with something like sweat lodges, with ceremonies, with other practices which are seen as very, very outside of an evidence-based paradigm?
We have to, you know, with the holistic and the strength-based side of things, as most people know, using the strengths of the child instead of the deficits. A lot of times with the evidence-based things, it's necessary for licenses and commissions and those kind of insurances. It's necessary to say these are evidence-based theories. But even our strength-based practices and models are grounded in evidence. So if you take a look at the cookie-cutter model of evidence-based, but yet you use that theory with the strengths involved in the child, you can blend it. With the use of the sweat lodge and the medicine wheel and the talking circles and the drumming circles, this is helping to heal the whole body, the spirit, the physical, the mind, and the thought patterns. Even if you notice here, especially here at my school, it's not all Native children. There's different cultures here. The majority of the kids that come to Talking Circle and Sweat Lodge and those things are Native, but they're from different cultures. They're not only Lakota, Dakota, or Nakota, but we're talking about Oneida and Seneca, Crow, you know, from all over Turtle Island. It's necessary to bring in their elders and their people to teach Longhouse tradition or to teach Seminole Miccosukee ways. You know, obviously I can't do all those things, so we bring in their elders. What you see happen with that, combining the strength-based and the evidence-based theories, is when these elders come in, the children who are non-Native, who don't have any Native blood ties whatsoever, are drawn to that practice because it's a sense of belonging, a sense of purpose, a sense of ritual. When things are going astray and out of practice, you know, you lost the sacred. So using a strength-based model gives them back that basis of sacred, gives them that basis of belonging.
What's the impact working with these young people, bringing these practices together?
Let me tell you about a young man. I'm not going to mention his name. We'll just say his first name is Alan. We'll say that. This gentleman came from Baltimore, inner city Baltimore, gang affiliated. Never been in the country before, never seen a sweat. Didn't know what a sweat lodge was, didn't know what a deer looked like. This young man was really on the edge. You know, he had probably done some things and seen some things that you and I would ever do or want to see. An African-American young man, and he came to us very rough. And he stayed that way for a while, pushed and fought, and in any way that we could help, try to help him, whether it was evidence-based, whether it was strength-based, it was nothing like you'd ever seen a young man. He was lost. This young man started coming. He was Muslim. That was his belief practiced.
He was what, Muslim?
Muslim.
Yep.
He was Muslim. That was his belief practiced. And he started coming to our talking circles, and he started coming to our sweat lodges, and he started coming to the medicine wheel. And you see this young man change. You see Alan start to change. You start to see him move up in the levels of the program because he had a place to truly belong. When he graduated our program, still Muslim, and he sang his songs in our sweat lodge. He sang his songs from his beliefs in our medicine wheel and shared stories of his beliefs. And he said, these ways, your holistic ways, connect in the way that we believe. They're interconnected. You know, the respect for the earth, the respect for one another. This young man became a leader. And he stayed on at our program further than he needed to because he chose to. He chose to stay to help the younger kids who were first coming in and struggling, which it had such an impact. So we're talking about a Muslim child of strong strength and stature. I mean, he was a leader of a gang. He was what they call a shot caller, right? And he walked away from this gang, and now he's leading these kids and tell them about his path and how to change their path. This young man graduated, and he's home today back in Baltimore. He's living further in the country. One of the things I remember about Alan is the first time I ever took him to a stream. He had never walked in a stream, a creek, before, and held my hand. He said, so let me fall. So we're talking about this big gang member, hold my hand so I won't fall. So I walked him across this water, and then we went camping. He had never been camping before. We never went fishing before. And he couldn't believe. He said, I've only seen these things in movies. That changed him. That changed him, and it changed me, Wolfgang. It changed me, and it changed him. This boy is home now today, alive and well, and working in this field.
That raises a really many, many questions in my head, all wonderful questions. But one of the questions it raises is, at Natchez Trace Youth Academy, you found a way to embrace all aspects of spiritual practice, and that's certainly something that we often don't speak about in this field. Certainly in academia, we don't talk a lot about spiritual practices connected to young people's healing or young people's work or the spiritual practices that we have. Yet you locate it specifically in your work, and you see it. It appears to me you see it as crucial to your work, your spiritual practices.
You have to heal the whole body. You know, if one thing is out of balance, you know, you take a look at the medicine wheel, and you have that unbalanced black road, per se, and you have the balanced red road, you know, per se. And, you take a look at poor role models and a good spiritual connection or unsafe environment. If you're in an unsafe environment, you can't learn and grow. I believe that there's a difference between religion and spirituality. You know, you're right. It is difficult in the work that we do to define religion and put that in practice or in session or in group. But if you look at the way that we walk and the way that we are with the world, with the earth, the four-legged, the things that fly and the things that swim, the things that crawl and Mother Earth that grows, how we're connected with that spiritually, that's a difference between religion, okay? When I approach my kids, when I approach our staff, and I speak about being spiritual, it doesn't necessarily mean sitting in the organized church pew, although, you know, I have nothing against that, don't get me wrong. But there's a difference between walking out in nature and walking down a river creek bed and recognizing water is the first medicine and recognizing that earth is there to support us and bringing a child back to those basics. You know, I've never been able to connect a child. When I first started working with children, it was back in the day when there were true wilderness programs, right? When we took kids camping and hiking and fishing for 28 days straight. You know, I'm a young man. I'm thinking, you know, I ride my motorcycle out this way,
And I meet a gentleman, and he's telling me about this job. And he said, you get to take the kids fishing and camping and hiking. And I said, you're going to pay me for that and feed me too? And he said, yeah, we're going to pay you good. I said, I'm in. Yeah, I'm here. No problem. Man, I get paid to go fishing. How better is that, right? There is nothing like connecting with a child, canoeing down a river for 3 or 4 or 5 days straight. You know, that's the true sense of positive peer culture. You know, the children working together. They have to work together to eat at the end of the day, to have their camp made up, and then to renaturalize everything and to hear their true stories and be at one with what balances us. I think that's where that spiritual comes from.
Indeed. Nicely put. I want to return to Alan for one more moment before we move into wrapping up. And the question I have is, Alan was African-American. Alan was Muslim. Alan stayed on to help other young people coming into the program. What is the role? I'm not Native. I'm not Aboriginal, to the best of my knowledge. What is the role of non-Native people in working with Native people, understanding the history, the legacy that comes before me?
Working with staff that are non-Native, one of the first things that I do is I do historical trauma training with them. I want them to understand the meaning of intergenerational disorders, or what we call residue effects of historical trauma. They need to first understand, you know, what effects have happened to our youth and why their behaviors are the way they are. Sometimes you'll have staff and therapists that come in and say, well, they're acting bad because of this, or they're acting bad because of that. When you have to, you know, you take your staff and you change their thoughts about that. Just like when we work with our kids, the 7 thinking patterns, we're helping to change that. We have to do the same thing with staff, whether it's direct care staff or whether it's therapists, to help them understand that the behaviors and the decisions these youth make are not their own. This came from somewhere else. These are pain-based behaviors. These are decisions that they made because they didn't have the proper opportunity for growth. When they start to see that, and then you physically take the staff out to the medicine wheel and you walk the medicine wheel with them so they can see that paragram, right? And they understand those effects of the dependency period. They understand cumulative trauma. They understand those things. They take a look at the children in a different way. It's important that they, you know, what's good for the student is good for the staff, that they have that mindset, that they too understand that each child is an individual. When we start grouping them, then we've lost our cause. And that's my main purpose with our staff, is to see to it that each one of these children are individuals, and their strengths and their input into their own healing is the most important. We're only here to role model behavior.
Very well said. As we wrap up, is there anything else that is important, you think, for our listeners to know?
You know, I want to say that when the traditional values of our Native leaders, and I believe this to be across all nations from one end of the world to the other, you know, New Zealand has traditional leaders, Africa does, all over the world, you know, there are traditional indigenous leaders of their own land, you know, and to keep in mind those traditional values, you know, if we can carry those in our heart, our work with the elder, our work with each other, our work with our wives and husbands and children, or and the work that you and I do with the youth that we come across, if we could remember the traditional values of our leaders, such as bravery and courage, generosity and peacemaking, wisdom and all that means, you know, humility, being able to recognize what humility is in us, you know, spirituality, that's important. Remember that's a difference between religion and spirituality. We can walk and go fishing or hiking or bicycling as you do every morning. That's spiritual. And family, how important family is. You know, when I say family, I mean what we say is fiscope, extended family, that there's more than just blood family, that your coworker is part of that extended family, your friend that you may meet in the evenings to talk things through, that's family. You know, and how important to hold those things sacred.
Indeed. I think that's a wonderful note to end on about how we're all part of an extended family, ideally working towards supporting all the children to make sure that they are healthy and that they stay healthy for future generations. Daniel Wolfshadow, thank you very, very much for sharing your humility, wisdom, bravery, and spirituality with us today.
Thank you.